The Main Calling Book Club reconvenes with a discussion of Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. Atul Gawande, a surgeon and writer, believes that in many ways, modern-day American culture and medicine have it all wrong, especially when it comes to how we approach end-of-life issues. His book, Being Mortal, is a call to change things. Instead of focusing exclusively on medical interventions that might extend life, he argues, we should focus on what's important to each patient as he or she enters the final chapter of life. The book is a bestseller. It has spawned discussion in churches and hospitals and among families across the country. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Main Calling, we hope you'll join the discussion of this thought-provoking book. The Main Calling Book Club's conversation about being mortal is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Main Calling. It's one of the most difficult conversations we face. How would we like to die? Modern medicine has done a great job of prolonging life, but in Atul Gawande's bestseller, Being Mortal, he argues that the medical profession has not done quite as well preparing people for the end of their lives. Gawande is writing as an insider. He is a surgeon as well as a writer who recently lost his own father to cancer. Today, the Main Calling Book Club takes on this weighty and so very important topic. With me in the studio, Candace Powell is Executive Director of the Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. Frank Chessa is Director of Medical Ethics at Maine Medical Center. Bill Lundgren is an Adjunct Professor of English at Southern Maine Community College, bookseller at Longfellow Books. His book reviews can be found at BillandDavesCocktailHour.com. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you read Being Mortal? What are your thoughts on how medicine has advanced and how it does or doesn't prepare us for the end of life? What are stories from your family? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Main Calling, or post to the Main Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And I just want to start by asking each of you your general reaction to the book. Candace, what did you think when you read it?
Oh, I really enjoyed the book. However, I must say, having spent 30 years in this field, nothing surprised me that he had to say, but I was really glad he said it so articulately that maybe it will draw the attention of a larger number of people to the fact that we really need to do a better job at really improving the quality of life for people at the end of their lives.
Okay, Bill Lundgren, what about you? You come from not the medical perspective, but the perspective of a reader and writer.
Right. So not being from the field, so much of it was just new information for me and incredibly striking and revealing. The idea that so many of us neglect to really attend to what we're going to do when the end of life comes until it's too late was an eye-opener, and really personally was an eye-opener for me. And the idea that he has a real sense of humility about himself. He learns a lot of stuff throughout the course of this novel or nonfiction work that was very undoctor-like, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, willing to open himself up and, yes, and be vulnerable. Frank Chessa, what about you? What's your reaction to Being Mortal?
I liked it as well. I thought it rang very true. And in many of the stories he told, I've seen in my time at Maine Med, similar stories unfolding there. And I particularly appreciated his personal stories about his father. My own mom is getting older. She's in her ninth decade of life. And some of the emotions and reactions he's had to what his dad was going through, I find myself. So on both sides, both the personal and the professional side, I thought it rang very true.
Did you have the same experience, Frank, that he had, that even though this is what you do and this is what you think about when it came to your own family, it was difficult to apply the knowledge and the skills that you advise others with?
Yeah, very, very much so. And one of the very striking things is when you're in your professional role working inside the system, you're very comfortable and you take on, you know, a role in actions. But when you're a consumer of healthcare, even a consumer of healthcare who knows the inside of healthcare, it's a very different feeling, and it feels very disempowering.
Candace, one of the points that is made in Being Mortal is the value of palliative care. And he lays it out. He uses a number of examples, but he talks about how people who go to hospice, I would say early, and when I say early, I mean compared to when most of us think you should call hospice, but when people enter into palliative care, they actually live longer. And that for him, that was a surprise. For him, he thought, gosh, if when people call hospice, that means it's the end of their life, mm-hmm. but that people often will live months and years in palliative care. Again, no surprise for you, but something that has been a challenge for you to convince the rest of us of, yes?
Yes, it's hard to convince people and bring them where they don't want to go. The fact of the matter is there's a lot of research, really, that shows that the more social support someone has and the more they know people are interested and care about them and their quality of life and have the time to spend with them, it really is directly correlated with the amount of time that people live. I mean, there's a lot of research on there, out there on that. And so I think people who live alone and are isolated and don't have any purpose for living, I think that was really something that struck me when I read the book. He talked a lot about people needing purpose. And I think even purpose and loyalty to other people is something that's so intrinsic to all of us. And if we're isolated and live alone and don't have any support and don't think anybody really cares about us and we don't have a reason to get up in the morning, it really, the research again is pointing to the fact that it might have a dramatic impact on the immune system, which has an effect on the illness itself. So, and the growth of the, in the case of cancer, the growth of tumors. So.
And the growth of tumors, the growth of tumors might be slower if someone is receiving palliative care.
Well, the jury's out on that for sure, but I know there's some researchers who are looking at that and trying to determine just what the impact is on stress and the progression of disease. So, yeah, it's a fascinating field.
Bill, what has been the response among the book lovers you talk with every day? What part of this book strikes a chord with others who have read it?
I think a lot of it is very cultural. You know, it really brings to the fore how terrified we are of dying in the West. And I don't know that that's typically characteristic of a lot of other cultures. We try to push that notion out of our minds and pretend that we're going to live forever until suddenly we realize that we're not, at which point Gawande points out really articulately, it's kind of late in the game to be doing that. And I think for a lot of people, it might have initiated, you know, I need to attend to this stuff now. I mean, not just, you know, getting old, but you could be in an accident and suddenly find yourself in a hospital with tubes out of every orifice, and which was absolutely something you did not want to have happen. But because you didn't attend to it, it is happening.
Frank, Atul Gawande talks about his own vulnerabilities, his difficulty with talking with his father, like we talked about before, but also he talks about his difficulty in talking with his own patients when he makes himself sit down, even after having done a lot of research, hung out with a gerontologist he admired, spent time in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. When he sits down to talk with his patients, honestly, he finds himself sugarcoating it. Do you think that this is universal in doctors?
Well, I don't know if it's universal, but I think it takes a good deal of reflection on the purpose of having conversations to kind of get out of the, the path of least resistance, which is going back on the tremendous knowledge that a physician has in the training and not using that knowledge and training as a crutch to simply provide information, but rather to stop, listen to the patient, ask the patient questions that really allow the patient to begin to articulate what they believe. One of the things I've learned recently in this field is that people need to develop and form their beliefs about the end of life. They don't come ready-made. So a physician's job isn't just to simply say, okay, there are the options, what do you think? The physician's job is really to help the patient ask the questions and develop the answers that really form in the patient's mind what they want for the last years or months of their life. And that's real art, and it's probably underdeveloped, but I've seen some folks do it really well.
Is that something that you're working on with the staff at Maine Medical Center? You said this is sort of a new part of learning how to help people develop their thinking about end of life.
Yes, very much so. I also have a role with teaching medical students at Tufts, and more in the medical student curriculum, the having conversations and even having conversations with actors who are playing patients and taping those conversations and going back and looking at body language and did you ask the open-ended questions. That's all becoming more and more a part of training for physicians. We've had Dr. Gwandi up on a couple of occasions to give us his wisdom in person.
Great. I have a feeling he never sleeps. I don't know how he does everything he does. I want to play a bit from an interview Atul Gawande did with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. And keep in mind, Gawande is himself a cancer surgeon.
Every push in our system is towards do something more. You know, I get paid more to do the operation by far than I will ever get paid to not do the operation. In fact, you know, we don't make it easy for people to have, right, to take the time for these conversations. You know, on the other side, the families and the patients, they can find it hard to acknowledge that we should be thinking about the worst case scenario as well as the best case scenario.
Right.
You know, let's go for the lottery ticket, but also plan for what happens if the lottery ticket doesn't come through.
I have a couple of thoughts from that clip. And the first is this whole idea that there are financial incentives to do something. Is that, in your view, Frank, part of the bigger issue here is that doing something is the default?
We have a very fragmented way of paying for healthcare in this country, and it's hard to say globally that doing something financially benefits or whether in some cases not providing the operation is financially beneficial to, you know, there are many, many players in the healthcare system, all of whom gain or lose depending upon these decisions. I think it's really important. And what we try to do is really insulate individual clinical decisions from any thought about what that decision means financially, really for any of the players aside from the patient who's going to or potentially could bear the burden of some of the costs. So, you know, I think that's a very important push in medicine to consider what the patient wants and what's best for the patient as the primary drivers and to really insulate clinical decisions from finances.
Okay. And the second part of his quote there, when he's talking about let's consider that we may have gotten that lottery ticket, but plan for the case in which we didn't. That, I think, is a really great analogy, the lottery ticket. We've all, you know, my father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and of course I seized upon the stories of the people who lived a long time with pancreatic cancer. I think it's human nature to want to have that lottery ticket. And Candace, do you find that that's a reason people might hesitate from entering hospice care, hoping they are the exception or planning on being the exception?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of it anyway. People have such fear and anxiety about having discussions, even with themselves, about the end of their life and their own mortality. I think we struggle with that. It's so insidious in our society. And so when you have someone who comes in very unassuming, very calm, very understated, and is just concerned about what someone's values are and what is important to them, it's almost so disarming to someone. They almost don't know what to do with that. But yet it's freeing at the same time for the healthcare professional when they come in and take the time to have a conversation. There's a quote in the book, and it says, if end-of-life discussions were an experimental treatment, the FDA would have approved it a long time ago. And I love that quote in Gawande's book. And it really, end-of-life discussions, when they're done thoughtfully and sensitively, they are actually freeing for everyone. And I don't know if that makes much sense to the listeners or to you, but Over all my years in this field, it's certainly true. People are so anxious about their own mortality. They struggle with their own spirituality. They struggle with many things and putting it in context for purpose in their life. And so I think we see that reflected in treatment options that are chosen or not chosen when someone is seriously ill.
And I think that's a really great point. And I'll say to our listeners right now, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'd love to hear about success that you've had having end-of-life discussions with family members or friends, or if you're looking for guidance from this excellent panel, feel free to call in or ask. And also, of course, if you've read Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, Gawande's Being Mortal, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post to the Maine Calling Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Kents Hill School, an independent college preparatory school in central Maine committed to helping each student make a difference in the world, kentshill.org, and the Maiden Law Firm of Eaton Peabody, statewide practice, local service, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland.
This week on Morning Edition, in the era of e-books, smartphones, and tablets, we're taking a closer look at the business and staying power of paper.
It's this thing that is so intuitive, and it's between you and paper and a pen. When I'm on my phone, it's never meditative. It's always tasky.
So get a pencil and make a note. Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
And you can hear Morning Edition each weekday morning at 6 a.m. For those of you who listen in Knox, Lincoln, and Waldo counties to our Camden station, WMEP 90.5 FM, the good news is we're going to upgrade the transmitter and do some much-needed maintenance at the site. The bad news is this is a substantial project, and it means that WMEP Camden will be off the air for perhaps 4 days. Weather permitting, we expect the work to start on Monday. We'll keep you posted. Please remember, you may be able to hear MPBN on 90.9 FM Bangor or 90.1 in Portland. And of course, online anytime at mpbn.net. Thanks for your patience and understanding.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, our book club reconvenes to discuss Atul Gawande's Being Mortal. With me in the studio, Bill Lundgren. He is an adjunct professor of English at SMCC and bookseller at Longfellow Books. His book reviews can be found at BillandDavesCocktailHour.com. Candace Powell is executive director of the Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. And Frank Chessa is director of medical ethics at Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we're going to start by going to Eve in South Paris. Hi, Eve. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm so glad this is on the radio. I read the book when it first came out of the library because I'd grab everything. It wasn't really in my eyes, but I had acute septicemia. I was on an internal backpack, total parenteral nutrition. I have three brothers with Crohn's disease. I have acute gastroparesis. And I sat and I thought, okay, the pain is so bad. And so I made out my will for hospice, but everybody says, you're too young. You're too young.
Well, Eve, I think that's probably something Candace would love to address. Is there an age rule about hospice?
Not really. Excuse me, Eve. Did you want to say something else before I respond?
I'm on main care, and it's like sometimes I've sat in hospital or I'll wait days to get this any medication or anything approved. And I understand that, but it's like people who are old, it's not fair to other people, my neighbors and friends. I just wonder about that.
Of course. Well, I don't have a lot of information to go on. What I would suggest that you do is talk to your local hospice program director. They're wonderful people, and you might need to get a little clarification on some of that information. Age does not necessarily have a bearing on whether somebody qualifies for hospice or not. There are guidelines granted, but there are many commercial insurers, and there is Maincare Hospice and Medicare Hospice. And so if you are appropriate, according to the guidelines for entry into hospice, then and or any of your friends, then and you're not getting access to it, I would just try to make time to have a conversation with your local hospice director and see if maybe there are pieces of information that haven't been forthcoming coming that might be helpful to you.
Good. But it's always good to know.
Yeah, and good luck to you, Eva. And would you say, Candace, that it doesn't hurt to have a conversation and find out
right.
with your local hospice and find out what's available?
Absolutely, and it's better to do it ahead of time. It's like preparing for surgery. You know, the anesthesiologist comes in and tells you what to anticipate and what to expect. Hospice is a wonderful resource among many resources, and it is appropriate for some folks, and some folks might not choose it, but it is a patient and family choice. So the earlier you find out the information you need in order to make an informed decision, really the better it would be for you or any of your friends or family, Eve.
Yeah. And Eve, among the other resources that are available would be, because you mentioned pain, is one of the considerations that's making you think about hospice, is a palliative care physician who, you know, might be able to help with pain, discomfort, symptom management, and have the palliative care physician join the rest of your medical team. But that may be helpful as well.
Good luck to you, Eve. We're going to move on, and we're going to go to Elliot and Connie. Hi, Connie. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to share that I have read the book, and I have talked with my daughter and my granddaughter who are to be sure that they know what my end-of-life plans are. I've talked with my doctor, and I've reached out to a local hospice person, but I'm not there yet, but I want to be absolutely sure that I'm that everybody who is part of my life who would be involved in my death will know how I want that to happen.
And Candace said for many people this conversation is liberating. Would you agree? Do you feel as though it was liberating?
Well, for me, I've been a longtime member of what used to be called the, now I'll forget, but there are organizations in almost every state that lobby for the keep an eye on the funeral directors to be sure that they offer the right kinds of listings of costs and that sort of thing. And so I've been preparing for my death for a long time while I've been busy living.
Well, Connie, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. I appreciate it. We're going to move to Camden and Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. It's a fabulous book. And what I did find is that there's an omission in terms of the choice of ending your own life or having an assistant ending, such as the state of Washington and the country of the Netherlands provide. Because sometimes, even when somebody's well taken care of in palliative care, it's just not worth going on. And we as knowledgeable patients have to know, especially in the state of Maine, what we can do. Would there be interference if we just decided to stop eating and stop taking liquids? I'm not even asking for medication help from the doctors. I know that's not within sight. But he doesn't mention that there are alternatives to continuing to live. And I think that's a failing in the book.
Well, he does talk about it briefly, and you're right, it's not the focus of the book. I'm going to read a paragraph I found on page 245. He writes, "Certainly suffering at the end of life is sometimes unavoidable and unbearable, and helping people end their misery may be necessary. Given the opportunity, I would support laws to provide these kind of prescriptions to people. About half don't even use their prescription. They are just reassured to know that they have this control if they need it. But we damage entire societies if we let providing this capability divert us from improving the lives of the ill. Assisted living is far harder than assisted death, but its possibilities are far greater as well." And he cites the Netherlands, in which many people end their life, but he does not feel as though the palliative care system there is good enough. So, and Candace, I know this is an issue you've thought a great deal about, and where do you come down in thinking about the movement to, you know, make it more possible for people to end their own lives with their doctor's help?
Sure. I have so many stories over the years of people that one lady even said to me, "It's not dying I really want to do, it's living I don't know how to do." And I think as a society of concerned, caring people, what we need to make sure is that we give folks all the options that are available to enhance the quality of their life. And I just encourage people who, you know, there's no right or wrong answer to this question on physician aid and dying, for sure. And I listen carefully to what everyone has to say. But as a society, we haven't even provided universal health care coverage for everyone yet. And a lot of the states in the United States who have passed this bill have also provided coverage, health care coverage for all their citizens. So I think we must not allow one social policy direction, even though it is an option in some states, to divert us from being the good stewards of improving the quality of life for our communities and our society. So I just encourage people to think about that maybe in a way they've not thought about it before.
Do either of you have Bill Lundgren?
I found really striking his the history of how this stuff has all evolved and how attempts to address what's really a social problem have so often been derailed by the intrusion of capitalism, which is never very compassionate and motivated simply by profit. It's particularly the assisted living program that the woman he focused on, that she began, was having tremendous success, but then as he put it, the developers became involved, people who were more interested in making money than they were interested in what the outcome was for the patient. And that should be the priority.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jonathan, thank you so much for your call. Frank, and this is something that really more of the book focuses on, the idea of what Bill brought up, the how to help out the whole assisted living business, how to improve the nursing home facilities and things like that, not only thinking about end of life at the very end of life, but as we maybe are a couple decades from that place.
Yes, that was a very refreshing part of the book for me. I'd known about Dr. Gwandi's views about close to the end of life from some of his other writings, but I hadn't heard what he had to say about, not the year or months before dying, but the process of growing older and having some of your physical and mental facilities decrease a bit and becoming really dependent on others and not really being able to avoid that dependence. So his descriptions there, I just thought were wonderful. I think his message, if you could put it in a nutshell, was we should be less concerned about the safety and more concerned about enriching the lives of older people and sometimes enriching the lives of older people, allowing them greater choice, allowing them to do things that aren't necessarily as safe as possible, cuts against safety. And, of course, our institutions who are concerned about being sued and living up to federal regulations and so on and so forth tend to err on the side of safety, which I think it's a real area for reform.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you bring up, and I don't know if these are related, but there are some really powerful forces in our society, whether the worry of being sued, if you know, my mother is in a nursing home and she falls and the nursing home said she wanted to go on that walk in the garden, you know, and on the other hand, the whole idea when we're talking about end of life issues, whenever this has come up before Congress, we have the language around death panels and, you know, not letting the government pull the plug and things like that. And so we're coming up, even if people have read Atul Gawande's book and even if they agree with how he feels about how our society needs to change, there are some really powerful forces pushing back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The ambivalence of families was really also, because as you just pointed out, it isn't just the nursing home that's concerned about safety. It's the family members of older people who tend to be more focused on safety than the older person themselves who might value a little bit more choice. So it's a very rich book because it covers all those different levels.
Okay, we're going to go to Portland. And Joan. Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Hi. I just read recently Dr. Gawande's book, and I say recently, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and it was before my mother died, March 19th, and she was in a nursing home but had hospice care. We started on a Thursday, and the following Thursday she died. But having the perspective on Dr. Gawande's book, which my sister and I both just loved, and his whole new perspective, and we talked about death among ourselves and our sisters and brother, and we talked to my mom and told her it was okay for her to go, and Dr. Gawande's book really helped put everything in perspective for us. So I just wanted to throw that comment out.
Well, thank you so much, Joan. Thanks for calling Maine Calling today. Candace, I'm wondering about the whole cultural idea that we need to fight. We need to fight. We need to fight cancer. We need to fight, you know, whatever it is that crosses our path. I know that in the past I was guilty of that, of hoping that my father would fight harder. Now a little embarrassed and ashamed of feeling that way. Is that part of the bigger problem here? Is that somehow accepting hospice or expecting palliative care is giving up a fight?
Well, I think that's been sort of reinforced in our healthcare system, unfortunately, over the years. And there, more and more people are realizing how, again, I'm going to use the word freeing, how freeing goals of care conversations are. But I think it's also the insidiousness of the fear and anxiety we have about our own mortality. And I think that's pervasive, not only throughout the healthcare system, it is also pervasive with a lot of healthcare professionals. I mean, I say to folks, my colleagues and students, that, you know, we need to address our own fears and anxieties as human beings before we can ever consider entering into a thoughtful, sensitive conversation with another individual and actually meeting them where they're at. And I find that a lot of people talk about the technical side of healthcare and focus on the treatments because they think that other people will give up hope if they are honest with maybe the prognosis. And again, research has shown time and time again that a conversation about goals of care, when done thoughtfully and sensitively, is actually enduring. It might be sad, but sadness is different than giving up hope. When people are on their final journey, they're actually, hope becomes known as, their interpretation of hope becomes different as they go along that journey. The perception of suffering for people is very different from the point of view of the observer than it is from the point of view of the person who is actually ill. And there's a wonderful study that was done by the British Medical and reported in the British Medical Journal years ago about that. And what they found is people who were ill, dealing with pain or other symptoms, what they wanted was somebody to listen to them and somebody to help manage their symptoms so they can have a better quality of life. Most people didn't want to die. They just wanted somebody to pay attention to them and give them an increased quality of life and help them maintain their dignity.
If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another short break. When we return, we'll hear more of your comments and questions.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Darling's Audi, dedicated to offering exquisite automotive design with the 2015 A6 and A4 Quattro, darlingsaudi.com, and Casella, handling over 1 million pounds of recyclables daily in the state of Maine, Casella, giving resources new life.
On the next Fresh Air, David Oyelowo. He played Martin Luther King in Selma. In The Butler, he was a civil rights activist. Oyelowo grew up in England and Nigeria and says he learned about African-American history through his movie roles. Living and working in three countries has taught him a lot about how race is perceived. He stars in the HBO movie Nightingale. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Ongoing annual member support makes MPBN Radio possible. Your contribution to MPBN through your will or estate plan can also provide long-term support for programming. If you'd like more information, talk to your financial advisor or contact MPBN at 800-884-1717 and ask to speak to Scott Marshallden. Thank you for considering us. We'd be honored to share in your legacy.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, our book club is discussing Atul Gawande's bestseller, Being Mortal. With me in our studio, Frank Chessa, Director of Medical Ethics at Maine Medical Center, Bill Lundgren, an adjunct professor of English at Southern Maine Community College and bookseller at Longfellow Books, and Candace Powell, Executive Director of the Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Going to Westbrook and Heidi. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Great program, and I just want to thank your guest, Candace, in particular, for emphasizing the quality of life issue. With my parents, they died several years ago, but a number of years before they did, we were revising their wills and also prepared advance directives. My mother was very open to talk about, but she and I have always had good conversations. But my dad was just like, don't talk to me about dying. And so he kind of just had to pick it out of him, so what he didn't want more than anything else. But as my mom was dying, about 6 months before she died, she started waking up in the morning and saying, am I still here? But she had always wanted to be conscious toward the last so that she could talk with me about her experience. And I have to give the hospice up in Augusta a huge kudos because they provided not only a lot of support, but also literature that made it, you know, that I was able to refer to and know when she was starting to die and was able to really focus in on talking with her and being with her and singing with her. And it was really a wonderful time.
Well, Heidi, thank you for sharing your story. And it's interesting because that's something Dr. Gawande talks about so much in the book is finding out what's important to each individual person. And it sounds like your mother was able to express that what was important to her was being conscious and aware. So thank you so much for sharing that. Candace, we were talking a little bit during the break about my own story and that I had said if I had read Atul Gawande's book before my father was sick, I would have done things differently. And you said, don't worry, Jennifer.
Well, it's easy to say don't worry, but I'm not diminishing the anxiety that caused you for sure. But I think what many of us who have worked in this field have seen over the years is that families walk away and they say, oh, what if I had done this? Or why didn't I think of that? And I try to say to them, we all do the best we can do at the time with what we have available to us. And then afterward, we have time to process it. And I just, it's more about grieving and anticipating the fact that you're going to lose somebody you love. And none of us are perfect human beings. I don't even know what that means. And again, we are all a compilation of our life stories and our values and our experience. And most people just reach down deep and do the best they can do at the time. And, you know, I think I want to assure them that that really is good enough.
Thank you. We're going to go to Deer Isle and Don. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually Deer Isle in Canada.
Oh, nice.
My question about the healthcare system, I realize it's quite different. Also, just in passing, I read a book. I haven't read this one yet. I've been wanting to. But there was one by a Dr. Pauline Chan, and I don't remember the title, but it's she's a cardiologist and deals with a lot of the same issues, and it was quite good as well. But a relative of mine has a terminal illness. And over here, my sister and I are actually very interested in accessing palliative care. But I wondered if it's the same in Maine. We've been somewhat discouraged from it in various ways because you have to, in order to get, we have palliative care doctors who work out of St. John, New Brunswick, and they actually do home visits. But the doctor, the family doctor, has to do a referral before you can access that program.
I suspect, are any of you on the panel familiar enough with the Canadian system to offer advice to Don? No, I'm sorry, Don. We don't have the right panel for you today.
Yeah. In the United States, though, we do have a shortage of palliative care doctors. And here, I think the reimbursement system really does not help us because, you know, if you think about the primary care providers, family medicine doctors, palliative care providers, essentially physicians who aren't doing some of the higher tech procedures, reimbursement for them is much lower than somebody who's doing cardiology procedures or cardiac surgery or neurosurgery. And so it discourages people from entering the field. And geriatrics is another medical field where, you know, rather than getting more geriatricians, which we so desperately need, we're getting fewer and fewer because reimbursement just doesn't support people going into it.
Candace.
Yeah, certainly in Canada, palliative care has been a specialty for many, many, many years. And so I hope you've explored that because there are many palliative care doctors in Canada. Have you explored that?
The thing is that the patient can't access them directly. You have to have your family doctor on board with referring.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told recently that it was described because we had inquired about palliative care that we had written him off. So, and he's better, a little better temporarily now. So we you know, that was the kind of, I just wondered what the attitude was, if over there it was the same. I'm finding the general medical professionals don't seem to be that keen to, it's like, okay, when you're going to palliative care, that you're giving up, wait for the last week or two to do that.
Right.
Might be time to find a new family doctor.
Yes, I was just going to say that, Bill.
Yeah,
sometimes you just don't have the right personality and the right person, and you do need to choose another, you know, primary care doc.
Don, good luck to you. We're going to move on and go to Susan in Falmouth. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd just like to raise a comment and also a question. My comment is that my mom, who is now 93, was in the Mid-Coast Hospital, and she was entered into hospice so that she could return to her home, which is in a senior community living situation in Brunswick. But she was living independently, and she had kidney failure. And so we were, my brothers and I and my mom were very happy to receive hospice care. And during that time, though, my mom continued to get a little bit better. And what we found was that the staff, the nursing staff, continued to tell her that she was dying. Well, she's still living. And we were, at times, sitting with her, with the nursing staff, hearing that she was getting better. And still the message was, well, she wasn't going to live very long.
And how long ago was this, Susan?
This was a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I believe, January or February of 2012 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
So she's still living. She still has not kidney failure, but her kidneys are very much limited. She has a number of other conditions, diabetes, heart issues. But this is a woman who I know that you're all saying, you know, when we talk with our parents, you know, perhaps we shouldn't encourage them to continue living. This is a woman who always says, I'm not ready to go. And we were thinking, well, that's a good thing. And then we were hearing other things from hospice. So that's hospice.
Okay. Go ahead, Frank.
It shouldn't be either or, should it? It should be
where the patient is.
It should be where the patient is. And you know, there's, I sometimes call it a middle path between getting all kinds of medical interventions, pacemakers, dialysis, surgeries, and, you know, and hospice on the other end of the extreme. Most of us, you know, say, hey, look, as long as I can keep moving forward with a good quality of life without too many medical interventions that may cause their own problems, that's what I want. And it sounds like that's the kind of the place where your mom is, which is it's great that she's continuing to move forward. You've put some limits in what you would accept as an acceptable intervention, probably. On the other hand, you're also saying, but we're also not quite ready to say we're in the last week of life and you know, let's make sure she stays in bed and let's do that. And it's that kind of keeping people on that middle path of good quality of life, you know, through what's really an uncertain period because nobody really knows, you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing though was that we were also told that she had to she was no longer eligible for hospice and that her if we didn't take her off for monitoring that she might not have any hospice services for when she really needed it. And so that was sort of another difficult time for us because we were never told how much time she had on hospice.
And Candace, you're nodding. You've heard this before, it sounds like.
I have. And sometimes, and I'm sorry that maybe the information wasn't clarified as much as I would hope it could have been. And sometimes we need to revisit with families what they understand about what was said right up front about hospice. And lots of times when people are under stress and families are dealing with issues that they wish they didn't have to deal with, we don't always hear things as clearly. And sometimes as healthcare professionals, we think we might be clear in our delivery of information, and we all need to check in with each other and make sure everyone is hearing the correct information. So when I hear a story like this, if I had been there at the time, I might have said, well, let's just pause a minute and make sure we all understand what the parameters are for hospice, what you and your family members understand about hospice. Lots of times families don't understand that there are guidelines. The insurance companies, whether it's Medicare or Medicare or the other commercial insurers, all have guidelines for who is eligible for hospice. And lots of times I know family members don't understand that. Even if they might have been told once, some of that information didn't stay with them. So when I was doing clinical work, I used to revisit that information periodically and make sure that people understood that it didn't come as a surprise if one day the primary nurse walked in and said, well, you know, I need to talk to you about maybe stepping off hospice for a while, and then if you need it again down the road, you can come back on. But that information often is not as clear as it should be.
All right. Thank you for your call. Susan, we have just a little bit of time left. Michael, we're going to try to get in one more call. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll try to be brief. I survived stage 4 colon cancer, and statistically, my doctor said I was 1 in 10,000. So it really what seemed at the time a real, you know, that death was what was going to be going on for me. And since then, I've talked to a lot of other people with cancer because they heard of my experience. And I just see a pattern of denial among educated people and among blue collar people that there is, it just, the denial doesn't seem to originate from the doctors so much as it does from the family, where it's just too terrible to really look at it in a factual point of view.
Yeah, and you know, Michael, I think that's what Frank was talking about earlier, is often it's the family who is having a hard time facing things. Thank you, and I'm so glad you survived and you called in today. Thank you so much, Michael. And that's going to have to be our last call. Candace, Frank, and Bill, thank you all for joining us today. Candace Powell, the Executive Director of the Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. Frank Chessa is Director of Medical Ethics at Maine Medical Center. Bill Lundgren, Adjunct Professor of English at Southern Maine Community College and a bookseller at Longfellow Books. His book reviews can be found at Bill and Dave's Cocktail Hour. John Keimel ran the board today. Our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. For next month's book club, we are turning to a classic that made news recently when its reclusive author announced she would be publishing a sequel. Join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, the story of Scout and her father Atticus Finch, Boo Radley, and racism in a small southern town in the 1930s. That Maine Calling Book Club discussion, June 25th. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.